Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. On today's episode of PD Stories, I'm interviewing someone I know very well, Sergeant Sean Sticks Larkin from the Tulsa PD Gang Unit. Now, while many know Sticks as my fellow analyst on Live PD, today we're going to get to know more about his background in law enforcement and hear his harrowing story of working a hostage situation. He's also going to tell us how gangs migrated to Tulsa and the methods his department uses to measure success in the war against them. Sticks, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you.
Good morning. Now, I know you pretty well. We've been working together for a while now on Live PD, and I just realized that I don't know how you got the nickname Sticks.
Well, I can give you the safe for TV version or the real version. How about if I kind of modify it?
We keep it real here on PD Stories.
Okay, we'll keep it real. So we're all big boys, boys and big girls here. Man, I was doing my internship with the Tulsa Police Department back in 1996 or so, I guess. I was 21 years old, and what my assignment was I rode along with a unit called the Footbeat Unit. And what the Footbeat Unit did is it handled the problems in our housing projects there. And this is back in a time when, you know, crack cocaine and crack houses were everywhere. And you know, gang members dressed head to toe in their gang colors. They stood out on corners. A little different than it is now. But so I rode with this unit every Friday and Saturday night. And it counted for my internship hours for school, for college. So I rode with the same two guys. They were young officers themselves, had maybe 3 or 4 years on, and developed friendships with them, just as I have with you. And one evening, we're out, we're in a car pursuit. They get in a chase with some gangsters in a car. Now, like I said, keep in mind, I'm just doing an internship. I'm not a police officer. I'm a college, you know, 21-year-old kid. And I was wearing a bulletproof vest that they provided to me, just in case, you know, heaven forbid, something went bad. And I carried a flashlight with me. And that was it. No handcuffs, no gun, no pepper spray, anything like that. So I'm young and I'm pretty confident, I guess, with my abilities, thinking I'm a police officer or my future hopefully becoming one. And one of the passengers bails out of this car. And I mean, to this day, telling you the story, I remember this thing vividly. I remember exactly where it was at. It was near one of these housing complexes, near a strip center that's even no longer there, but I can visualize it perfectly. So the passenger bails out of the car and I jump out of the back seat because the officers, you know, they ride in partners, and I chase this guy and catch him pretty quick. So I tackle him and I get him on the ground, and, you know, luckily for me, I guess this bad guy just thought I was a cop. And so he didn't really fight, but here I was, 21-year-old kid laying on top of this gangster without any handcuffs, without a gun. And so the officer catches up to me, the passenger that night, his name was Mike Eckert. And he catches up to me, and he's, you know, we get the guy handcuffed, and he's like, "Hey, man, great job, but you can't do that stick," and fill in the blank there for what that word was, you know. And so that was kind of the big joke. And then once I get hired, and I was in the police academy, Eckert and the other guy, his name was Luke Sherman, they were both some of our firearms instructors at the range as well. And so they kind of just started calling me Stick Boy, but it was actually short for F-Stick for that night. Man, then once I got on the streets, you know, the way the gangster language goes, you know, it's kind of got this own little street vibe to it. And, they would hear my name as Stick, and they thought it was Sticks, or they kind of morphed it into Sticks. And to this day, that's what it, everybody from the judges there in Tulsa to our Live PD viewers, yourself,
America,
everybody.
Now it's America. America knows Sticks Larkin. Now, what did you major in college, and where'd you go to school?
Man, I went to, so, you know, I've talked about it before. I'm a Bay Area kid. My parents are both in the military, and I grew up there in San Francisco. And once I finished high school, I moved out to Oklahoma. My parents divorced just before my senior year. My father moved from the Bay Area to San Diego. My mom had family outside of Tulsa, so she moved out there. And I actually stayed my senior year of high school back out in the Bay Area and lived with one of my friends. So I kind of knew I was going to be a cop. I mean, I knew from 15, 16 years old. That was
really?
That was the path I was going to go. You know, I was very fortunate. I wasn't one of those guys that got into college and changed majors and wasn't sure what I was going to do. You know, I was dead set, knew this is what I was meant to do, so to speak. And so I moved out to Oklahoma after I finished high school, had no intentions on staying there in Oklahoma. you know, wanted to go back to the West Coast. Actually despised the Oklahoma area. It was just so far behind the times from what I had grown up, you know, seeing and doing there in San Francisco. But I went to a junior college there called Roger State, got my associate's degree in criminal justice, and then I transferred to Langston University. So I majored in criminal justice with a minor in corrections. And I worked full-time all through college. You know, like I said, I moved out when I was 17 years old and kind of been self-sufficient since then. And I drove a beer truck for Anheuser-Busch, worked full-time during the day, and went to college at night.
Were you the first person in your family to go into law enforcement?
I was. Well, I say that in my immediate family. My father is originally from Chicago, and his father and I believe a uncle of his were both Chicago PD people. But primarily, you know, my family's military. Like I said, my mother, my father were both active duty. My brother was active duty. My sister's been active duty. So, you know, our whole family has kind of been in that service role, I guess, or either that or we don't know how to dress ourselves, so we have to have a uniform every day. You know, we can't match colors, so we gotta wear whatever they provide to us.
Well, what was it like being a rookie cop in the 90s when you came on? What year was that?
I started in January of 1997. Mm-hmm. You know, and for me, growing up in the Bay Area, I would never trade that, you know, for what I was able to see and experience, you know, as a teenager and a kid. However, as a father, that era, you know, I look back on it now and I'm like, gosh, I'd hate to have my kids grow up around what I did. Not necessarily the area, just kind of that time and what was going on in that era. Because, you know, the early mid-90s, I mean, that's when, you know, street gangs kind of manifested into what they are now, you know, from the late 80s, the crack cocaine problem that came along with it and things like that. And so for me coming on as an officer, you know, still during that time when, you know, gang shootings were very frequent, you know, the drug sales was going on and the violence that went along with that, you know, it was a very, very busy time for me. You know, from, I mean, I remember literally the first night I was a rookie officer on my own out of field training, maybe 25 minutes before my shift got over, I got in a fight with a guy over crack cocaine.
On your first night?
My very first night, swear, about 25 minutes left in my shift. Yeah, I mean, I was at 500 East 56th Street North. That's, the, you know, an area there in Tulsa. And I remember I was out on a car stop and just trying to pat a guy down who was probably twice my age. And it was just one of those deals that, you know, there's, they call them pre-attack indicators. You could just tell, hey, this dude isn't wanting to cooperate. And it turned into a fight, and it was because he had dope on him.
Did you win?
I did, man. And I'll tell you what, you know, we see it on the show also. An officer need call goes out, whether it's the officer himself getting on the radio and saying that, it's toned out, or just, you know, you can tell just the stress in an officer's voice how different it is. You know, sometimes when they come on the radio and you hear those sirens coming to you from a distance, you know, it's honestly, it's the best feeling there is. So, and I remember that night, and I remember some of the guys that specifically showed up that night.
So kind of take me through your first experiences as a rookie, the things that really stand out or most memorable.
Probably one of the weirdest things I remember, it was just getting used to having people look at you. Because, you know, it's just, you know, if you're
in uniform.
In uniform, exactly. If you're a normal person going to work in your regular car, wearing regular clothes, you know, you're just, nobody necessarily pays attention to you. But when you're in a marked police car, wearing a uniform, sitting at a stoplight, everybody's looking at you. When you're, you know, getting out to walk in and get a coffee somewhere, everybody's staring at you. And so that was just, it took a while to get used to that.
Yeah, it differed me too.
It does. It's different. And I mean, it's not in a bad way or anything. It's just people naturally look at police officers. And so that was something that was really interesting to get used to. You know, the shift work was different. You know, when I worked in college for Anheuser-Busch, I had to be at work at 5 o'clock in the morning. And as a rookie officer, as you know, and every
other night shift,
you catch the crappy hours. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's bad hours for family life, great hours to be a policeman.
Right. And you wanted to work in the diverse neighborhoods in Tulsa, right?
Very much so. You know, Tom, you've gotten to know me and, you know, some other people, if they've paid attention to the show, you know, I've talked about it. You know, growing up where I grew up in the Bay Area, man, I was a hip hop kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up doing, you know, everything that was cool was a fad. I mean, I did.
Did you break dance?
I did break dancing.
What?
Yeah, I was gonna say I did break dancing. I did skateboarding. I did, you know, street freestyle on a bicycle.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I just bought an adult size BMX bike.
And he can still walk on his hand.
I can handstand walk. Yeah. Hey man, you got to keep it ageless. Keep moving. But you know, so growing up out there, and I went to Dr. Martin Luther King middle school. You know, that was the name of my middle school there in South San Francisco. And then my high school was called Fairfield High, which was a suburb of San Francisco. And I mean, the race stuff just was not an issue there. I mean, that's the difference between going up in a city like that or, you know, a large city compared to some of these smaller areas. And so when I moved out to Oklahoma, it was a shock to me how racially and financially segregated parts of Tulsa were, and especially the suburbs, the areas around it, which is where my mom lived. And I mean, it was genuine culture shock to me. You know, guys were wearing, you know, duster jackets, which are those long cowboy coats, you know, and driving trucks that had, and this is not a joke, driving trucks, the you know, 18-year-olds would have a rifle up in their back window.
Yeah.
And it was just like, this isn't.
That's the other America. That's not San Francisco.
Unbelievable. You know, and those are the funny things I say, but there are also some of the negative stuff, some of the derogatory statements I heard about other races. I mean, I was just like, I can't believe, you know, people literally think this way or still, you know, believe this type of stuff. You know, because of how I grew up, who I grew up around, what I paid attention to me, it was just, you know, a natural, easy thing to go into the gang world. It was something that interested me. Even though I have a different background than some of the guys I deal with, obviously it's pretty easy for me to relate to them, to talk to them, anything from, you know, music, cause I stay on top of, you know, current hip hop music, tattoos, you know, that type of thing. It made it just a really easy transition for me.
Do you remember the first time you were really ever scared on the street in an incident?
You know,
and maybe not just scared, but where you knew that I'm in danger here.
Yeah. The first time I was scared, I've talked about it before, was actually from a dog. I had a dog that just came up behind me on an alarm call that literally scared the crap out of me. To the, you know, just came up behind me barking. I was on this alarm call at a house at night. I was there by myself. Backing officer hadn't got there yet. And you go to a million bogus alarms. I mean, you go to them all the time. But this thing scared me so badly. And when I got back in my car, my hands were literally shaking. Now, I've been in, you know, I've been in foot chases, car chases, I've been involved in shootings. I've been present with other officers when they've shot, and I haven't had that type of reaction.
That Chihuahua scared you that
bad?
Oh,
yeah, it was a little bigger than a Chihuahua, buddy, I promise you. But so, you know, I don't know how to explain it. I've been very fortunate that I think I have a calmness to myself. Even when I'm at work, I don't panic. It's just, it's one of those deals that it just, you know, I'm comfortable in what I'm doing. I know myself, my abilities, the people that I choose to work around that work around me. You know, I feel the same way about them. So I've never had this real scared moment necessarily.
Yeah, I know exactly that feeling. My personality is very much like yours.
Correct.
When I was out there, I was always calm, confident in my abilities, and just able to think my way through things clearly.
Yep.
When did you go on to the SWAT team in Tulsa?
So the way our police department works is our SWAT team is not a full-time SWAT team. We just don't have enough, call outs, you know, work necessarily for them. So like, you know, majority of the SWAT teams across the country, they're kind of on a part-time basis. And in order to get into any type of specialty assignment on our police department, you have to have a minimum of 3 years on the department. And a specialty assignment is anything other than a patrol officer, anything other than someone who's taking calls for service. So if you're a detective, a narcotics officer, a canine, SWAT team, all those, they're considered specialty assignments. Well, when I was in the police academy, I knew, you know, I knew the side of town I wanted to work at. I knew I wanted to be a gang officer someday, and I knew I wanted to be on the SWAT team. Those were my goals. So once I got my 3 years on the department, you know, I filled out the application to try out for the SWAT team. Actually, the two officers I did my internship, they were both on the SWAT team by this point, and I developed friendships with them, and I just knew that was the route I wanted to go.
Now, tell me about the test that went wrong.
Okay, so when you apply for the team, you've kind of got a like a, you know, a written packet that you fill out. It's just the general information about yourself. Why do you want to be on the team? You know, just like any other job application. You then have, you have an oral board as well, and you have a couple scenarios, some tactical scenarios you have to go through. In addition to firearm qualifications, you obviously have to shoot a little bit higher than a standard officer does. You know, you got to demonstrate proficiency. Well, on the scenarios, you know, I remember staying up studying the hell out of these things. You know, if they tell me this, I'm going to do that. You know, I read all our policies and procedures that have to do with, you know, anything to do with our SWAT team. Talk to, you know, experienced officers. Well, this one particular scenario they put you in, it's called a HRT, a hostage rescue team. And in a hostage rescue scenario, basically everything's out the window as far as safety for the officer. And I don't mean you're reckless. It's just the primary goal is you're there to save the hostage. So it's a little more riskier. It moves quicker than other SWAT type deals. And what you're supposed to do is go to where the threat is and stop the threat, essentially, and save the hostage. So meet with the other two actors, which are SWAT guys that are already on the team. And there's two of them in front of me. And they're like, all right, you know, we're going down the hall. We're going to rescue. You can hear the shots being fired. There's a woman screaming. So we start moving down the hall. One officer peels off into the room. The officer in front of me gets shot and drops down on the ground screaming for help. Well, they're trying to see if you're going to stop to help the officer or progress forward, which is what you're supposed to do. Officer goes down. I don't freak out. I don't render aid to him. Well, I think it's a trick. And this building is a two-story shoot house. And I think the shots are from upstairs. So I stop, turn around, find the stairs, and start going up the stairs. I get about halfway up the stairs, and the guy running the scenario is like, okay, stop, thank you. And right then I knew. I never made my way to the hostage or the never saw the shooter, and that was what the goal was. I knew what I was supposed to do. I just thought it was a trick.
You just didn't get there.
I just never made it there. So basically, in a real-world scenario, that poor hostage did not make it.
But you went on to have a good career on SWAT anyway.
I did. Well, I actually ended up being an alternate. I mean, I'm not ashamed to say it. I literally went home that night and I had tears. I knew I'd screwed up. You know, I knew what I was supposed to do. And I, you know, when I had my oral board, it got brought up in there. What the hell was I doing? You know, because these guys knew me. And I told them, I said, man, I thought it was a trick. I thought the shots were actually upstairs and you were trying to find out what I was going to do. It was just the echo in the building took me a different direction. So, but, you know, just telling that story, it kind of gives to the confusion of
fluid situations.
Absolutely. Well, fluid situations and just, you know, your perception of things and stressful situations and, you know, gunfire, you don't necessarily know exactly where it's at. You know, there was some talk about that, this horrible deal that happened down in Florida. I just saw something on the news yesterday. They weren't even sure if, you know, shots were coming from one building or another at one point. So it can be difficult to tell.
Was there any one incident that you experienced with SWAT that really bonded your group together?
Yes. So on our SWAT team, there's basically three 10-man teams. And, you know, you train as an entire team at times, but for the most part, your entry team is that 10-man group that you're with. And so you're with these guys. We have training days twice a month. And then you have, you know, we got together on the weekends. We went running together. We worked out together. You know, we got together for private events, together parties, things like that. Well, I've been on the team for a few years at this point, and I was pretty comfortable in my role. And on our team, I was the ballistic shield operator. And Tom, I'm sure you know, if you're the ballistic shield operator, you're the number one guy.
You're going first.
You're the first guy. And that's kind of how it works. You have that guy, then you have what we call a scout that usually runs the number two spot. Then your team leader's three, so he's kind of dictating what goes on. And I, you know, was the shield operator. We had gotten the call out one evening while I was off duty of a guy that was living in an apartment, had shot a woman like 12 or 13 times out in this parking lot of an apartment complex. And they had a romantic relationship. She had two kids that weren't his, and they all lived together in the same apartment. Well, officers show up. They actually are able to extract her out of the parking lot through another apartment through a back window. Another officer.
And she was still alive?
She actually survived. She's still alive to this day. No
what?
Joke. Yes. Swear. It. Yeah, she did. Kudos to her. But honestly, it was like 12 or 13 times.
Shot 12 or 13 times.
12 or 13 times. Yep. Dead serious. So the first officer that actually showed up on scene was this guy named Donnie Wright. And he's pulled into the apartment complex and the suspect is outside and he actually starts shooting at the officer while he's in his car. And so this isn't your typical, you know, domestic type deal where the guy inflicts damage to the female and then gives up or anything like that. This guy's hell bent on, you know, continuing on whatever he's doing by shooting at the officers. Well, as I mentioned, I've been on the team for a few years. I was, you know, you kind of get a feel how these type of scenarios go. And not to say that you're relaxed by any means, but you just, you know, the majority of the time they're going to turn out a certain way. Well, we had been trying to negotiate with this guy for, I don't know, an hour, hour and a half, and we had no response whatsoever. You know, Donnie, the officer that showed up and got shot at, said this guy fled back into the apartment. So we tried phone calls, you know, loudspeakers, things like that. Just no response whatsoever. And we didn't have a light turn on or off in that house. So we thought that one, the suspect was either had killed himself, or two, had possibly fled out of a rear window before a rear containment had gotten set up, you know, as officers are still responding. Because generally these type of things, you have something, you know, the guy might, you know, get on the phone and negotiate. He might tell you, you know, screw you type of deal, but we had nothing at all. So a decision was made that we were going to go up to the front door and do what's called a breach and hold. And basically just get the door open, whether you have to physically bust it open or if it's unlocked, you open it and you kind of take a peek inside so you can make an assessment at that point. So we move up to the front door, team of six of us. I'm the shield operator. So I get up to the door, I squat down, set my, you know, full size bunker shield down on the ground. I lean forward. We open the front door. And as soon as the door opens up, we start taking shots. The guy had posted up inside the apartment on a corner near the bathroom and started shooting at us immediately. What was kind of funny about this deal was he shoots, and I just have a pistol because, you know, you carry
the shield in one hand, you got your pistol around the side of the shield.
Exactly. You know, and it's got a little a ballistic window, you know, that so you can kind of look through and see. Yeah, it's very small. I mean, it's not crystal clear, but you can see through it. So I'm looking, he shoots, I shoot, he shoots, I shoot. And my team leader, this guy named Dave Davis, and, you know, going back to what I talked about being calm and not freaking out, it was one of those scenarios, and Dave was the same way. And Dave just goes, as calm as can be, right when this has happened, he goes, you know, Sean, what you got? And I just go, he's shooting at us. And Dave's like, I know that. Where is he at? You know? It was just this weird conversation, just as calm as can be, right in the middle of this thing. And basically what Dave was asking was, you know, kind of where's he at? Because we know we're going to have to make this entry a dynamic entry now. It's kind of changed things by him shooting
at us.
It's
a hot situation.
We know these two kids are inside, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's one of these deals, if the kids aren't inside, yeah, we're going to unass it and retreat. There's no reason for us to push it, you know, even though he's inside. Time's on our side when someone's by themselves. But when you've got kids in there, you know, their safety is our concern.
And you don't know what room they're in.
We have no idea. No idea at this point. It was a one-year-old and a three-year-old that were in there. And so the decision was made to throw in what's called an FSDD, a flash sound diversionary device, is the technical term. Most people know it as a flashbang. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's thrown into the room, and it basically is designed to disorient the suspect. It's extremely loud, has a very bright light, and it's supposed to give the team a few seconds to make a move inside the room to try to, you know, put the suspect down. More shots are going back and forth. By now, other people that are over the team, they're actually leaning over the top of me with their MP5. One guy's shooting an MP5, another one's shooting an M4, and we're putting rounds back to where this guy was shooting at us. And we throw the flashbang in, the decision's made to go in. We go in, and he had retreated around a corner back to two bedrooms that were both closed. And so we're working our way towards it, and all of a sudden this guy yells out, hey, I got the kids in here. And so we took that as a, hey, man, don't come any further.
Back off.
Exactly. That's how we took it. So at that point, once again, it changed. And this is, you know, as we talked about, you've got to be fluid. You've got to be able to adjust to these things in law enforcement. And so at that point, you know, we held our position. We weren't even sure which of the two rooms they were in.
You just could hear him
we
say this.
We could hear him, correct. And we eventually were able to narrow it down just through dialogue. We could tell, okay, he's in this one room. And so negotiations continued on for an hour and a half or 2 hours or so.
While you held that position?
Yes. We ended up rotating out. We would rotate our team in with another team back, you know, in and out. And to kind of go back, when you're talking about being scared earlier, when I talked about the dog, this scenario, during the whole time, I wasn't scared. Once we got relief for the first time, and I remember going out to our armored vehicle, it's called a Saracen. Getting out to the Saracen, it was like I could not drink enough fluids. The cotton mouth I had in my mouth just wouldn't go away. And that was something, just a physical reaction my body did to it. That you know, I'll always remember. But then when we would rotate in and out, you know, there was at one point where Dave had said, he's like, all right, Sean, if we're going to make this dynamic entry into the room, you know, to put this guy down, you know, he's telling me, Sean, you know, we'll open the door. You're going right to the guy. You start putting rounds in him. And majority of law enforcement things that happen, a car stop or a call that you go to, it's just automatic reaction. You know, it's training and things like that. You just, it's just second nature. You do what you're doing. But to sit in a hallway and have that be told to you from your team leader and knowing, hey, in 2 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever, I might have to open this door and I'm going to go with two kids in the room, have to go at a guy with a shield and, you know, and start dumping rounds in them. That's the stuff. I wouldn't say your mind messes with you, but when you're thinking of it,
There are serious consequences.
Very much so. That's when it's, you know, I wouldn't say the reality kicks in, but you just start realizing, holy cow, this is about to go down.
How did it end?
The guy actually ended up just walking out of the room at one point. Didn't even tell us he was coming out. Scared the crap out of us. Just came out the door, just came out of there with his hands up. He had been shot during the exchange of gunfire. He actually got shot through a wall because he was posted up on the corner, and we kind of figured it out. It was one of the guys shooting the M4.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. 223 rounds would go through drywall like nothing.
So one of those rounds are the ones that got him. He just got shot up in the shoulder and the arm area. You know, he came out, turned himself over to us and was arrested. You know, then myself and another guy named Brian Hill, we went in and grabbed the kids. There was a one-year-old and a three-year-old, and Brian carried one kid out, and I carried the other. And
it's a good feeling, wasn't it?
It was. It was amazing, man. You know, I'm a father, and Brian's a father, and the majority of those guys on the team are. You know, and that's the whole job is you're, you know, as a SWAT team operator, is the bad guy's going to go where he's supposed to go to. The officers are all going to go home, and the innocents hopefully go home as well. And that's what happened on that day.
Was there a downside to the aftermath of this incident?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of egos in SWAT across the country. I think the police profession as a whole has a lot of egos. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of have that type A mentality oftentimes. And so sometimes you get too many of those guys all in the same room, the same place. There's differences of opinions. And that kind of happened here on this deal. My team leader and another team leader had a difference of opinions on what should have been done that day from the initial entry. Mm-hmm. Basically, we made the decision to stop and open negotiations. Some others thought that we should have never stopped. We should have kept going, you know, at the guy.
Even with the kids there?
Even with the kids there, yeah. It was basically the opinion of this was a hostage rescue deal, and so on a hostage rescue, you go until you get your suspect. And that's how hostage rescue typically does work. But you know, it is, you know, I've been to training, while on the SWAT team that has been taught by, you know, from the West Coast, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, which is a, you know, one of the leading SWAT teams in the country as far as experience and training and, you know, who they are recognition wise. And I had training from NYPD's, SWAT team. And you know, that's who taught me ballistic shield movement was NYPD. And they have two totally different ideas on how they handle things. So it's just not to say one is right, one is wrong. But what happened on that day, it kind of turned into this political thing. I mean, our mayor's office got involved. The chief of police was involved. There were people who were, you know, forced to resign from the team. Some quit the team. And it just kind of took the fun out of it for me.
You know, that's really crazy when you think about what this ended up being the best possible outcome of a terrible situation that could have been the worst scenario with two children and this man dead, and maybe even one of you.
Yes. You know, actually speaking of that, one of the guy named Virgil Literal, he's still on the SWAT team to this day. He got on the same time I did. And he actually was shot on that deal. Just kind of a fluke deal. It's hard to explain here without having, you know, the listener see it, but you know, you wear this vest on the outside of your gear, mm-hmm. and he is leaning over the top of me with the M4 as I'm kneeling down with the shield. And we didn't know it on that day, but our next training day, he opens one of the pockets up in his vest, and he has a little, I don't know, it's a monocular, I guess, a single binocular. He has one of those in his little pocket, and he pulls it up, and it's destroyed. And all the glass fragments are inside of this little pocket. And so he and I are looking at it on this training day, and so I look into his pocket for a moment. We pull a bullet fragment out. And so actually one of the suspect's rounds, and we find the hole in his vest. It just didn't hit him directly on. Mm-hmm. It hit him at an angle and actually went into his vest and hit that. And he had no idea. Didn't know it for like 10 days.
Wow.
Yeah. Talk about crazy, huh?
Wow. So when did you go on to the gang unit?
I actually applied for the gang unit as a young officer. I didn't quite have my 3 years on. And, you know, I mentioned you have to have 3 years on. I hope they would have, you know, had some special waiver for me or recognized my potential. It didn't happen.
Why do you want the gang unit?
Man, it's, I like the action. You know, you want to, I mean, I like that whole world. I like talking to those guys. You know, I like the chase. You know, I've got 21 years on, man, and I still like chasing these guys. So it's just, I, you know, that's the personal side of it. I like the action. I like the chase, the adrenaline of that type of thing. But, you know, these guys that we deal with, you know, here in Tulsa, that are associated with criminal street gangs. These are the guys that when people turn on the news in the morning, you know, when they're getting up, having their cup of coffee, getting ready to go to work, take their kids to school, and they see a robbery that happened overnight, or they see a shooting that happened overnight. I mean, here, honestly, last night at 1:30 in the morning, my guys are texting me, my guys, meaning my officers in Tulsa, some gangsters that we know were doing a ATV burglary at a ATV motorcycle shop. And four of the five guys got caught, and they're all former gangsters that we deal with on a regular basis. And so these are the guys that are out there causing havoc, you know, for us in the city of Tulsa.
Terrorizing their own neighborhood.
Exactly. That is. You know, it's a small percentage of guys that are in these communities that are doing it. It's the same people over and over and over again. So I'm not saying all gang members are like these type of guys, but there's just a small percentage of gang members that account for the majority of violent crime. And so, you know, I like going after those guys and, you know, taking those guys off the street to make, you know, the city of Tulsa a safer place.
Sticks, tell me about the basic daily activities of the gang unit.
Yeah, we've got a squad of 15 officers counting the supervisors. We've got a dog assigned to us who's just a narcotics dog. And our typical day, you kind of come in, you've got to handle your administrative things, you're checking emails, you know, answering to the bosses, you know, the things they want done. Oftentimes we've got community requests, either questions they have or issues that they're having as far as graffiti or, you know, a problem at their business or school that they think is associated with gangs. So we handle those type of things. And beyond that, it's pretty much all self-initiated activity. Every guy that's selected for that unit, they have a reputation of being able to produce their own stats. They don't need to be told what to do. They don't need the radio dictating where they're going to go, anything like that. And so if they're not working an active informant or working an active shooting and get investigation that they're doing follow-up on, you know, we ride two guys to a car, sometimes three to a car, and they just get out on the streets. And the whole goal is to reduce violent crime there in the city of Tulsa, make contact with as many people as possible, be visible.
Sticks, what are the primary goals of the gang unit?
Man, if to give the general, generic statement, I guess it's to reduce violent crime in the city of Tulsa. And kind of the way we do that is we try to take the firearms out of the hands of those that should not have them. We actually have a dry erase board in our office that we keep track of the number of guns recovered going back to 2008, which is when I came in there. And that first year in 2008, we recovered 63 guns. In a calendar year. Our unit was a little bit smaller at that time. The previous supervisor, they were more focused on narcotics and money seizures. And, you know, I kind of just viewed it like, hey, man, we're supposed to stop the shootings, the robberies, the murders from happening. How do we do that? You got to take the guns away from the guys that are out here doing those things. So we made this this change in going strictly after firearms. That's what I cared about. I don't care how much dope you confiscate and put on the table. Doesn't matter to me. Get a gangster with a gun. So we started making that our focus, and actually last year our gang unit recovered 355 guns. And so you can see the difference, you know, in the number of years. Every single year it's pretty much gone up for the most part. And the way I look at that, or we view that, our department views that, is every single one of those that we have taken away out of the hands of someone that shouldn't have it, that night it wasn't used in a shooting, it wasn't used in a robbery, it wasn't used in a murder. And you know, so even though the city of Tulsa last year had 81 homicides, 82 the year before, which is actually a record, you can only imagine how many more shootings, homicides that would have happened had these guns not been taken away from these gangsters.
And a lot of those guns come back as stolen from residences, right?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, these guys aren't the guys that are walking into
doing straw purchases,
Dick's Sporting Goods and buying a gun themselves, or they're not getting their girlfriends to go buy it. You know, they're not showing up at the gun shows buying it. The majority of these are taken in burglaries. They're sold on the streets for, you know, a fourth of maybe what they're worth. They get passed around quite a bit, resold. And that's why, you know, residents at home, man, we beg people to keep track of their serial numbers of their firearms. Because a lot of times we actually recover a lot of guns that we know this 16-year-old kid with this $500 Glock, you know, we know it's a stolen gun, but it doesn't check back stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to do a little more follow-up paperwork. We get what's called an e-trace done, which is, you know, the ATF basically tells us who this gun was sold to, and we have to do a bunch of follow-up. And ultimately, we end up finding out oftentimes these guns are stolen, but it really helps if, you know, gun owners keep their serial numbers. That way, when they discover them missing, they can provide them to the officers.
And find the best possible way to secure their firearms to keep them from being stolen.
Yes. I understand home protection. You want to have one out there, but, you know, when you've got multiple guns and you just lay them out in your closet, or you're sticking them under the mattress, or you're sticking them in the top underwear drawer, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. That's where these guys, when they break in a house, they're not in there for 2 hours. They're in and out of those places very quickly. They know where people keep these type of things, and that's what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. But unmarked units, right?
Yeah, they are unmarked units. They're not necessarily undercover cars. I mean, we drive, you know, your Ford Tauruses and Ford Explorers, your police Explorers. They all have spotlights. They have black rims on them, the tinted windows. They're just in different colors. You know, they don't have any of the decals on the outside that say police, but I can assure you every bad guy knows where the police, when you hit the neighborhood, they know you're coming. You know, I kind of joke that it's the soccer moms are about the only people that don't recognize our cars, because, you know, we'll be driving down the highway and one of them will fly by us, you know, 20 miles over the speed limit. I'm like, man, how could you not know this is a police car right here? You know, it's very obvious.
Tell me about some of the gangs that are most prolific in Tulsa that you deal with.
So the gangs in Tulsa, they are they originated in L.A. back when the crack cocaine started spreading across the country. That was basically how it moved across the country. A lot of these criminal street gangs based out of Los Angeles and trying to
expand
their enterprise, their drug enterprise. These gangs moved to other cities across the country, including the Midwest, you know, taking crack cocaine out there. And so that's how it got started, basically in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Our street gangs are very loosely organized. There's not like this Don or this OG at the top who's making decisions and dictating who gets to do what and who's paying money to who or who do you get to go kill. It's very opportunity-based, very emotionally-based, spur-of-the-moment type of things that happen. So we have, you know, all your major, your Bloods, your Crips. We got your Hoover Crips, your neighborhood Crips. And there's a ton of subsets below these things. You know, we've got our Hispanic gangs.
Which ones, like MS-13?
No, we actually don't. We actually had one family that was legitimately from El Salvador through L.A. to Tulsa. A couple, they were a, ironically, their last name was Fitzpatrick, which is
they were Salvadorians named Fitzpatrick?
Yeah, Salvadorian Irish. It was something the way the family was married or something like that, but they okay. were legit from El Salvador. But, you know, one of those guys, he was murdered in a gang shooting. A couple of other guys ended up going to federal prison. And they were like our really only MS-13 group here in Tulsa. Now, our largest one is the Storeños, the Southsiders. They use the number 13. We've got Florencia, Latin Kings, the Juaritos. You know, those are all our Hispanic gangs.
And you have Norteños. And to explain that to the audience, there are basically two regional subsets of Spanish gangs on the West Coast, Mexican gangs primarily.
Correct.
Norteños means from the north,
right?
And Sureños means from the south.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Sureños means southerner, and Norteños is for northerner. And basically, the way the state of California, pretty much every facet, including gangs, it's kind of almost like two separate states.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, I think it's Fresno is kind of like the dividing line mm-hmm. they use for the gangs, basically. And so they've got rival colors. You know, the Norteños wear red, Sureños wear blue. They're enemies in prison. And because they're enemies in California, these two street gangs are enemies everywhere else in the country as well. So in Tulsa, we have a small group of Norteños. You know, they're not too big. The majority of our gangs are all kind of connected with our Southsiders, as we call them, the Sureños. And so they fight, you know, amongst the other Hispanic gangs there in Tulsa.
Now, if you had to say, this is the one gangster I've dealt with in my 23-year career that was just the hardest, most gangster dude you ever encountered, who would that be?
Larell Battle. Larell Rufus, his middle name was Rufus, or not middle name, but he just went by Rufus, uh-huh. Or they call him Big Hunted.
Big Hunted.
H-U-N-D-I-D.
Which is like 100, right?
Yes. And he's from our Hoover Crips, you know, that's our largest gang in Tulsa. And this guy, I started dealing with him when he was young. You know, I was a young officer. He was younger than me. He was a teenager. And it was just one of those probably of five guys that I've dealt with that just gives you that little tingling feeling in your body. Like, this dude is the real deal. And the rail battle is definitely one of the guys that sticks out for sure. And he's actually in federal prison right now for a murder. He killed a federal informant.
Wow.
While he was taking out his trash.
That's gangster.
That's gangster, man.
What's your proudest moment?
Man, I just got into the gang unit as a supervisor there. We had a gang shooting that happened on a Saturday night, early Sunday morning at a club. And the suspect vehicle used in this thing was a maroon bubble Caprice, you know, your 94, 95 Caprices. It was between our Hoover Crips and neighborhood Crips. Well, the next morning I get called from our homicide detectives about a shooting with four victims that had been shot. One was dead, like 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. And it was a maroon Caprice that had been shot up. And the car was five deep. There were five guys in it, but these guys had all just left church. And it was five young black males, all I think like 17 to 20. And the guy that had been shot the night before, one of his friends saw this maroon Caprice and thought these were the suspects from shooting his buddy the night before.
And it wasn't.
It wasn't. So he sees them at a convenience store. He runs back to his house a block away and gets a rifle, a .223, and then jumps in a car and literally like out of a movie, sits up on the window. You know, rolls the window down in his car, sits up on the window as they're going past this Caprice, starts lighting it up with his rifle. They crash. They actually stop in front of it and start dumping more rounds into it. Mm. So one kid died. Another one ended up paralyzed. Another one lost an eye, actually got shot through the face and lost his eye. Another one ended up having a shot through the chest, collapsed lung. One guy somehow didn't get hit. But within a matter of a few days, we actually recovered the murder weapon. We got the driver of the car who ended up cooperating, and just about 2 weeks later, we ended up catching the suspect. And so for me to be a new officer in the gang unit, to see something that violent happen to, you know, kids coming home from church, mm-hmm. and to make the apprehension of those guys and get convictions, you know, for these guys, that was honestly the proudest moment in my career.
Did anybody get the death penalty in that case?
No.
No?
Nope. Nope. Didn't get the death penalty. It's actually... It's pretty rare, especially in the gang world, that we actually get any of the gang murders as a death penalty.
Testifying in court, what's that like for you?
You know, the early years when you testify in court, you're a nervous wreck. You know, because and the attorneys, they know it. You know, they see a lot of the same officers over and over again, and so they kind of get to know you personally. They know how you testify, whether or not you've prepared, and you know if you know what you're talking about. So when you first go to court, you kind of get eaten up. You know, the defense attorneys know that, and they'll kind of tear you apart. But you learn from it. You know, you learn from your mistakes. You learn of things you said that you shouldn't have said. You learn when you speak longer than you need to. You know, you kind of start to learn. You answer the basic question and leave it at that. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, I'm fortunate. I've done a lot of courtroom testimony. I'm actually recognized as an expert witness for gangs, and so I testify very frequently in gang murders in Tulsa, kind of laying the foundation for how gangs operate, why, and then why this particular murder happened. And, you know, for a lot of your jurors, they're not from that world. And so when they show up in court, it's kind of an educational piece and an eye-opener for them that, hey, this type of stuff is going on, you know, here in your city. So I actually enjoy it. I enjoy going to court. You know, I know a lot of the judges. I'm friendly with both the prosecutors as well as defense attorneys now.
Have you ever had credible threats against your life or your work as a police officer?
You know, I wouldn't say necessarily credible threats. You know, I genuinely mean this. I mean, I treat people well. Even if they're bad guys, I treat them well. You know, I'll get into the talking back and forth, you know, with a guy just because I'm a grown man. I'm not going to let another grown man, you know, speak poorly to me. I'm going to give it as well if you start giving it to me type of deal. But I don't ever make anything personal. I don't take the stuff that they do out there personal. I know it's they're doing what they do. I'm doing what I do. And, you know, we're just kind of interfering with their day, so to speak. You know, I don't ever talk bad about these guys as kids or their mamas or anything like that. You know, those are the type of things that'll set somebody off. You know, you make it personal. And so I've never had a legit credible threat that I've worried about. You know, you hear guys that just, you know, they'll post stuff. They're these social media gangsters. You know, they post stuff on social media talking crap all the time. You know, they'll say, you know, whatever they want to say about sticks, and then I'll stop them the next day in a car stop. And they're like, hey, man, how's it going? You know, I saw you on Live PD, man. I like what you're doing. You know, and you're like, man, you were just online yesterday talking crazy about me, you know. So that's just part of that world. But, yeah, nothing that's ever worried me.
How does social media aid the gang unit in solving crimes out on the street.
Man, every single one of these guys has got social media. And, you know, that's just a day and age that we have now. And it is amazing what morons these guys are and what they post on there.
Here's me with my gun and my weed and a stack of money.
Yes. And I'm an ex-con. And,
right.
Hey, I've got weed for sale. Here's my phone number. Hit me up.
Literally on social media?
Oh, yeah. We see it all the time. And I can't tell you how many times we have texted these guys, you know, from a number, from one of our cell phones. Hey, man, I want to get some bomb, you know, which is a street term from weed. Let me get, or, you know, let me get some syrup from you, whatever it may be. And they want to make that cash. So they're not vetting us. They're not figuring out who we are. You just make up, you know, I'm such and such as homeboy, or I'm such and such as girl. You know, we'll pretend we're a girl.
And greed is driving their motivation.
And these idiots show up repeatedly, you know, and they're meeting undercover cops. So they're meeting us out there. We just see them pull in and we know who they are. So yeah, social media, it's amazing. You know, one of the best things about it is when a shooting happens, right away there's people on there talking about it. Not necessarily the suspect that was involved in it, but people that know about it, they start putting stuff out there on social media all about it. You know, the friends of whoever got shot, they're posting, you know, who they're going to get back at and stuff like that. And so from an investigative standpoint, that is huge for us. And now it is very common for us in court. We're actually, you know, issuing subpoenas for people's Facebook, their Snapchat and stuff like that. And we're able to use that actually as evidence in court.
Do you think that street gangs are in many ways, or some ways, the equivalent of terrorist organizations?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the definition, what a terrorist is, I mean, it's, you know, that word to a T. I mean, these are, you know, they're not on the large scale level, obviously, but they are affecting the way people that live in these communities live their lives. You know, they're having to adapt their life because of the activity these people do. You know, people live in fear, which is essentially what a terrorist wants. You know, they're doing it for typically political gain. That's probably the big difference. I guess terrorism is usually, you know, geared around religious or political, you know, type of issues. These guys are just genuine bad guys, maggots, is a term that's used for them, but, you know, that are causing problems for the people in their community.
Now that you're a veteran officer with a couple of decades of experience, you also teach at the academy?
Yes. So every officer that goes through our police academy, as well as other law enforcement, you know, officers within the state of Oklahoma, they all have to get a certain amount of training every year, just like law enforcement anywhere else across the country. And one of the things that they have to do in order to graduate the police academy is they have to have a certain block of instruction on criminal street gangs. And so I teach there at our police academy. We run 2 to 3 academies a year. So myself and another officer typically teaches that. I've also been very fortunate to actually teach a segment for the DOJ. I've taught in Florida, Ohio, Louisiana, Texas, you know, traveling around speaking for DOJ about criminal street gangs as well.
What's your one piece of advice for rookies?
I tell it to every time I speak to this academy. This job is the best job in the world. You know, you're actually going to make a pretty decent salary here. You don't have somebody looking over your shoulder. You're your own boss. The majority of the people really do like you out there, despite what you see in the media. You've got a chance to make a difference in where you live. This job is fun. It is. You get to work with your buddies. I mean, you get to laugh and joke. And, you know, if you want to take a coffee break, you go take a coffee break. If you want to, you know, go sit down with your buddies and eat dinner, you get to go sit down with your buddies and eat dinner. So I really talk to them about physical fitness. Because that's very important for this job.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of stress that comes along with this job. You've got to physically and mentally take care of yourself to carry yourself through a career. But I tell them, I'm like, man, I love this job. I promise you, if one of you guys needs help, I'm going to come running to you no matter what, even if we have our personal differences. But if you hate this job, if you just want to come to work and squad meeting and complain about the job or what the city isn't doing for you, get the hell out of the work. You know, get out of this line of work and go find something else to do, because there's other people that want to do it.
You know, people talk about, you know, so much discussion about bad police officers, but it's like every profession has a certain percentage of people that should have never gone into that profession. I've had a bad dentist.
Yep.
I mean, and a bad dentist can really, really make you miserable.
Yeah, absolutely.
The difference is in law enforcement work, you actually have the authority to perhaps legally end someone's life. And so there are people that go into police work because they just want to make that money. They just want that salary and really should have never been. I'm sure you've worked with some that you knew this person should never, ever have gone into this line of work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think you hit it right on the head. I look at probably our department, there's probably a, 10 to 15% of the people have no business wearing the uniform for one reason or another, just they're plain lazy. You know, if we were in out in the public sector, these people would be fired just because of lack of work product or charged for embezzlement for getting paychecks and doing nothing, you know? Mm-hmm.
And every department has some of those people.
Every single department. Mm-hmm. It is. And it is so frustrating to know that this is a job that I love to come to work and do every day. And, you know, I try to hustle and work around guys that hustle. And to see someone who's got 3 years on this police department, who's 26 years old, who's worthless. You know, and I'm just like, man, is this what you're going to do for the next 20 years of your life? You're going to come to work every day and, excuse me, complain about this job and do nothing, basically? And then there's probably that top 10 or 15% of the opposite. These are the guys that show up day in and day out and bust their butts. Mm-hmm.
And make a real difference.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, and those are the guys that are fortunate that do end up in specialty units oftentimes and make a career of being in these units, making a difference. And then you've got those same guys that are complaining, well, why is he in that unit? Well, because he works hard and you don't. You know, and then the rest of the department, you know, they kind of fall in between, just depend on how their day is going or who they're around, you know, who they're working around in an assignment will kind of dictate what type of officer they're going to be. You know, and I wholeheartedly believe that.
You know, I worked with some officers like that. I mean, when I was in diplomatic security, we were guarding the main State Department and other State Department buildings around D.C. And there were a small percentage of people I stood post with. Who we be talking about, well, what would you do if a van load of terrorists suddenly pulled up, jumped out eight deep with AK-47? And I had some of them tell me, I'm running. And I'm like, I'm glad you told me.
Yep.
You know, I'm glad you told me because now I know what to expect if something really goes down. I'm going to stand my ground and do what I'm here to do. And if you run, that's on you. If I die here defending this post, that's what will happen.
You know, and when I was on the SWAT team, we did training for the rest of our police department, and this was you would teach active shooter training. Mm-hmm. And so you would teach every single officer in the department from the chief down to the school resource officer to the, you know, the detective, the canine officer. Everybody had to go through it. Our helicopter pilots had to go through it. Mm-hmm. And so you see sometimes how scary some of the people you work around are. And not to say that they're going to be cowardly and not show up to do what needs to be done, but you can just tell the difference in somebody who takes this job serious and who someone that just gets up and puts their uniform on and gets to come to work and collect a paycheck twice a month. It's a huge difference. And just that scenario you're talking about, listen, that's a terrifying thing to think of, you know, especially if you're armed with a pistol and you've got bona fide, you know, terrorist or something like that happen. But sometimes, man, it's a terrible day to be a cop, but you've still got to do that job. Mm-hmm. You know, there are scenarios that pop up where you're like, this sucks. And, but you've still got to do your job.
You do. And my last question is, how has Live PD changed your life?
Man, where do I start? You know, I think as a person, I'm still exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still go to work, you know, work with my guys, hustle, just do the same job day in and day out. I'm obviously much busier now. It's changed my life because I didn't have any social media, so I've had to learn the social media game. Getting to come out here to New York City, meet Tom Morris, Dan Abrams. You know, I've never been out here. But a big part of it, man, it's changed my life because I've gotten to connect with so many people because of this opportunity. Not just you guys, not just the people in the TV industry, but across the country. You know, to get messages from fans of the show are great, but the ones that mean the most are when I get other law enforcement officers from other parts of the country that send me a message. Hey man, I like what you're doing on there. Thank you for looking out for us, or thank you for explaining this to people. You know, those are the ones that mean the most to me, honestly, is hearing from my peers, knowing that I'm representing them well, not to say the face of law enforcement, but you know, this show is in the limelight. It is such a huge hit. So many people are watching it. It's about law enforcement, and to be a representative of this profession and hopefully doing it well has been just amazing.
Well, I view you as a friend, colleague, and brother, and I'm so glad I get to work with you every week. And I'm so happy that you came on PD Stories and shared your experiences with us. Thank you so much, Sean Sticks Larkin.
Tom, my pleasure. Anytime you want me here, you know I'm here for you, bud.
I know it. Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.